Our reading this morning are words that have been adapted from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. This is where we are. Where do we go from here? First, we must massively assert our dignity and worth. We must stand up amidst a system that still oppresses and develop an unassailable and majestic sense of values. What is needed is a realization that power without love is reckless and abusive, and that love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice. And justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love. And this is what we must see as we move on. On March 25th, 1911, 146 people died in the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. It was a Saturday afternoon, 4:40 p.m. to be exact, and the workers were just finishing up for the day. Most of the employees were women who were either Italian or Jewish immigrants. They worked 52 hours a week and were paid $7 to $12 a week, not per day, not per hour, $7 to $12 a week. In today's dollars, that averages out to around $3.50 to $6 an hour. These young women were not allowed to go on a break outside to catch their breath, or even if they wanted to, have a cigarette. They were not allowed to go out for the entirety of the day because the doors were locked behind them in order to discourage them from stealing anything from the factory. So when some of the cloth caught fire in this building, there was nowhere for them to go. The factory was located on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of the Triangle Building, and some of the workers, desperately trying to escape the smoke and the flames, climbed out of the windows and hung on for dear life, waiting for the fire department to come. And many of them could not hold on for long. When the fire department did finally come, the nets that they used to catch the women were ineffective against the height from which they jumped. One young woman went to the window ledge with a big, broad-rimmed hat and flung it into the wind, took out her purse, threw out the few dollars and coins she had, and jumped. A young man who was working in the building walked onto the window ledge and grabbed the hands of women who wanted to get out to the window in order to help them jump. A first, a second, a third. As the fourth woman he helped up came to the ledge, she flung her arms around him and gave him a passionate kiss and jumped. He followed. And Frances Perkins was a woman who witnessed all of this. Frances Perkins was a woman who came from good upper middle class stock. She was very well educated for the time. She held bachelor's degrees in both chemistry and physics and a master's in political science. This is 1911. She was attending an afternoon tea with friends when they saw the fire trucks go by. And her and her friends went to investigate. And Frances Perkins witnessed these people struggle for their lives and fail. And witnessing that changed Frances Perkins forever. It was the moment that she decided to dedicate her life to workers' rights. Now, Frances Perkins was not new to the field of working people. She had been advocating for better working conditions before the Triangle Shirtwaist fire. She led the New York office of the National Consumers League, where she had been working to better workplace conditions, wages for women, child labor laws, and ironically enough, fire hazards in the workplace. She was no stranger to those awful conditions that laborers faced in her time, and it was her belief that the poor treatment of the labor force was part of the reason the economy was not doing well. So intellectually, she had been doing this work. But something changes when you witness tragedy firsthand. It's no longer something that happens to other people. It's no longer something you can push aside. It's not something you read on the front page of the paper and forget about in 2 weeks. This is something that is now very real. Frances Perkins witnessed this fire when she was 31, and I want you to think about being in your 30s for a second. Being in your 20s is a fun time where you happen to be a really loud, optimist activist. At least I know I was. And when you hit your 30s, you get this little moment of realization that maybe I need to grow up. Maybe I need to start doing some things, and maybe this optimism and fight is just too tiring. 30s is when you start to settle down. I can't say for sure that Frances Perkins, a suffragette, labor activist, and savvy political person, was beginning to slow down at the age of 31, but I do know that she points to that moment in her life as solidifying her fight, her commitment. After that, she started to work with local government officials to try and improve labor rights, getting them to pass laws little by little to better the workplace environment for those people. And as those efforts became more and more successful, she started to gain more and more attention to the people in the state, New York State, in which she was living. And in 1929, she became the first commissioner of the New York State Labor Department, appointed by their brand new governor, this gentleman named Franklin Roosevelt. And when he became president a few years later, she joined him in the cabinet. She was the first woman to sit on a presidential cabinet. She was the Secretary of the Labor Department. For those of you who know government, does anyone know government in this area? For those of you who know government, when you're on the cabinet, you're in the line of succession for the presidency. She's the first woman to be in the line of succession. Her work in that cabinet was instrumental in the New Deal. She helped draft the Social Security Act. She was instrumental in legislator ensuring a minimum wage, a 40-hour work week, a two-day weekend, overtime laws, that wonderful time and a half you get, child labor laws. She was instrumental in helping develop welfare. For those of you who work, who are able to take a long weekend this weekend, thank Frances Perkins. And if you are able to take tomorrow off, I ask you, please, take a minute and remember the 146 people who died in the Triangle Shirtwaist fire, those mostly young female immigrants. The ages of the people who died in that fire, 14 to 41. 123 of them were women. Remembering them is what this weekend's about. It is Labor Day weekend. People who labor are the people that move the economy of our nation. This is a holiday that started back in the late 1800s. And if you think about where our economy was as a country back then, we were moving from an agricultural economy to an industrial economy. And just like any systemic change, people don't like it and they grumble. So how do we put those fears at rest? Let's have a holiday to celebrate industry. Let's have a holiday to celebrate labor. And like any systemic change, there are going to be abuses. Locking the door of a factory was common practice a century ago. Child labor was a common practice. Why wouldn't it be? In an agricultural economy, did the children work on the farms? Yeah, you bet they did. Why would this be any different? These things happened because industry and this economy was new, and they had no idea how to run it humanely. They tried to put an old system on a new idea. The owners weren't interested in making sure people lived. They were interested in making sure they met the bottom line. They wanted to make a profit, and there was a large pool of immigrant workers for them to choose from, and let's face it, they're expendable. If they want better jobs, they should go and find them. Sound familiar? 100 years ago, we moved from an agrarian economy to an industrial economy. And now we are moving from an industrial economy to a service economy. According to the statistics from the U.S. Department of Labor, yes, Francis Perkins Department, the 2017 statistics say that 40% of the United States workforce is classified as either management or professional. So that would be your professors, social workers, psychologists, librarians, nurses, doctors, lawyers, ministers, etc. 39% of the workforce is sales, service, and administrative. Cashiers, waiters, prep cooks, nurses' assistants, hotel housekeeping, baristas, data entry, customer service, and others. The other 20% of the workforce is transportation and agriculture. There are just about as many professionals as there are laborers. And I put those in quotes because I'm willing to bet a lot of those laborers think of their work as being very professional. And just like 100 years ago, we are still trying to figure out what is fair and just in the workplace. So let's start with that idea of a minimum wage. What's the federal minimum wage? $7.25 an hour. So, if you work 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, that gives you how much a year? $15,000. $15,000 a year. Who here can live independently on $15,000 a year? I am so glad none of you raised your hands. That's the minimum wage. Do you know what the minimum wage was intended to do back when it was started by FDR? He actually spoke on this. I quote, "No business which depends for existence on paying less than minimum wages to its workers has any right to continue in this country." By business, I mean the whole of commerce as well as industry. By workers, I mean all workers, white collar class as well as men in overalls. And by living wages, I mean more than bare subsistence level. I mean the wages of a decent living. Is $15,000 a year a decent living? The minimum wage is not about teenage seasonal help. It's about giving anyone who works an opportunity to have a decent life, to treat them with the worth and dignity they deserve. I'm sure some of you here have heard about this group called Fight for 15. It's a group supporting the minimum wage increase to $15 an hour. And I'm going to be honest with you, when I first heard that, my first thought was, let's not be unreasonable. $15 an hour, that's more than double the minimum wage. That's ridiculous. But let's do some math. Y'all like math. What's a one-bedroom apartment in this neighborhood run rent-wise? $1,500. I did my research. How much are utilities a month for this place? Electric, water, trash? $200? Reasonable? More than that. All right, we're going to go lowball on this stuff. All right, let's say you have a health insurance payment where you work. $220 a month sound reasonable? Is it more? Less? More? Again, we're lowballing. You get a big copay on this one. All right? How much for groceries a month? We're going to say $300. How many of you can do $300 a month for groceries? Okay, I'm not sure if that laughter means I'm going to be eating well or if I'm going to be eating barely. I have a family of four and I can do it, but I'm a really good grocery shopper. Car payment and insurance, let's say $250 a month. A little low, a little high? A little low. Okay, again, we're lowballing all of this stuff here. All right? All of that together, how much? $2,470 a month. Guess how much you need to make an hour to cover that? $15. That's $15 an hour to cover that. And notice, we lowballed a lot of that stuff, and we did not include things like Netflix, the occasional Starbucks now and again, right? We didn't include clothing. We didn't include gasoline for the car, right? Maintenance for any of that. We didn't include an internet service provider. We didn't include tax. That's take home. That's assuming that all your taxes are paid. And you know what else we didn't include? Childcare. Oh. How much childcare a month? I'm going to say $400, and I'm going to say $400 for a non-accredited, low-ball, dangerous-looking childcare. All right? $800 to $1,000. Unless you've got mom living nearby who's offering to watch your kid who's retired. $15 an hour. Think about that. Think about the people who are asked to work two jobs, each one of them 35 hours a week to make ends meet, living with roommates, not able to take time with their kids to help them with school. Do you know what the number one indicator is of a child's success in school? They did a study, heard it on NPR, everyone heard it. Doesn't matter if it's a private or public school. It's time with the parents. And if we ask these people to work 80 hours a week, where's that time? We are committing these people to live in a cycle of poverty. You know what else is in workplace abuse nowadays? Sick days. I want to talk about sick days for a second. Every employer has a different rule for sick days. You have to be working so long to get a sick day. You only get so many sick days a year. Sometimes they accrue them, all that other fun stuff. I'm not going to get into that. What we're going to get into is how they won't let you use them. If you work in a job and you call in sick, so many places say you need a doctor's note. Remember that insurance payment? How much is that copay going to be for that doctor's visit? $40? Can you afford that $40 if you've got a head cold and all you need is a day of rest? No. But you can't call in sick now, can you? No. So what do you do? Go to work sick. I can attest to this personally. I got to come down for this one. This is a personal story. You got me on the mic? All right. I worked in a company that bought and sold used camera equipment. I was a cube jockey, and I was getting about $10 an hour, and I had a three-year-old daughter who had a head cold. My wife was an elementary school teacher, still is, and it was my opinion that her work was more important than mine, so I would stay home with the kid. She has to teach. I have to sell cameras. I think I can miss a day or two. My daughter's not improving after the second day. So we take her to the pediatrician, and the pediatrician says she's dehydrated. She needs to be hospitalized. She's going to be okay, but she needs to be hospitalized. 2 days in the hospital with my daughter. Now, this is my daughter's first trip to the hospital, and this is my first daughter, so of course I'm going to be a helicopter parent, and I'm going to stay with her. And I stayed by her bedside for 2 days while my wife worked. I go back to work, and I get the worst grief from my employer. Next performance review comes around, I'm all fours and fives. Beautiful stuff. I'm good with customers. I make them feel like I'm listening to them. No raise. All right, fine. Company's going through a hard time. I understand that. Next year, performance review, fours and fives. How about a raise? No. Okay, so why not? Well, we don't think you're a company man. Excuse me? Well, you took those 4 days off in a row. Think about that. You put your family first, so you're not getting a raise. Now imagine you work at a cashier's position or in a fast food restaurant. What happens if you take 4 days off in a row because you've got a family emergency? Yeah, you're fired. Can they legally fire you for doing that? Right to work? It depends on which side you're on. If you're in Virginia, yeah, they can do that. And even if they can't, they'll find a way. They'll say you were lazy at work, you missed a shift, something. This is what happens in our service industry. People are disposable. They have so many similarities to our industry 100 years ago. The people who work in these jobs are overworked, they are underpaid, their working conditions can be dangerous, and they are easily replaceable. They need a Francis Perkins. They need somebody who's going to witness their pain and feel what they are going through. I mean, Frances Perkins was an amazing individual if you think about her accomplishments on paper. She was in an era where women were still not allowed to vote in 1911, and she found a way to make change happen. She used her connections that she had made early in life, her incredible political talent, her tenacity to bring about change. But the biggest gift Frances Perkins gave was her ability to feel the pain and suffering of injustice. She allowed herself to be changed. She allowed herself to feel what others were going through, and she used that to call herself to action. That's what Labor Day should be about. It's not just a celebration of the labor force, but it's an opportunity to witness the injustices that it perpetuates. Yes, we could do some celebration of the labor force, but it should also be a call to action, a call to make sure that all who work are treated with dignity, that they can afford decent housing, decent food and clothing, that they don't just survive in this world, that they thrive. So who is our next Frances Perkins? Who is going to shoulder the burden of making labor just and fair? And I'm looking at y'all. Well, here's the good news. It doesn't have to be any one of you. But I have bad news. should be every one of you. There are lots of little things that we can do to place that first principle of dignity and worth into the labor market. The first thing is to vote locally. Find those candidates who support unionizing sales and service industries. Find the people who support the $15 an hour minimum wage. Shop as much as possible as businesses you know pay and treat their employees respectfully. And please do not assume that all small businesses do that. And if you're a small business owner, pay a fair wage. Now, I had a bit here where I was going to talk about you have to make sure all of the members who work for the congregation are paid fairly as well, but according to Catherine, that's not a problem, that everybody who works here is paid a living wage. That's good. I hope that she's not lying to me. I doubt Catherine would. But keep it up. We have to live into our values at every level. We live in a nation that defines people by their job. What's the first thing we tend to ask people when we meet them? What do you do for a living? And you know what we need to do? We need to make people who have to say, I work in service industry, give them a reason to be proud of that. Tell them there's no shame in that. Pay them the respectful wage. Give them the respectful life. We sung about bread and roses this morning. We're not even giving them bread. But everyone deserves the beauty in life. Everyone deserves a rose. The people that do these jobs are a vital part, not just of our economy, but of our everyday lives. They deserve respect, justice, and compassion, just like everyone else. They too deserve a rose. May it be so.